Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial for Citywire USA, and I'm joined by Citywire RAA Editor Ian Wenick and Citywire RAA Deputy Editor Andrew Forsch. Andrew, Ian, how are you?
I'm good. I mean, you almost missing Andrew's title. I mean, that's kind of like, I think, a parent forgetting the name of their own child.
So it's only been 5 years, Alex.
That's no. So listen, right? I just got confused as to whether to say Deputy Editor of Citywire RAA or RAA Deputy Editor. You know, it's just, you know, I knew. Look, for a long time,
you recovered well, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, until we sort of exposed it and then picked up the scab to sort of round out the intro. Yeah, I think I got Sam's name wrong on the podcast at least sort of four times this year. He seems okay with it. Either that or he's, you know, buried it deep inside, and at some point I'm going to feel the full force. But look, those are the job titles. These are the people. This is going to be a great episode. Not only is it our last episode of the year, I'm afraid, dear listener, we are taking a little break for the holidays, for sort of Christmas, New Year, and we'll be back fighting fit on the week of January 5th, I think. It's also our 50th episode. I was going to say, if you can believe that, but in a way, maths will do a lot of the work for you. We started at the start of the year, there tend to be 52 weeks in a year. So here we are, 50. But that's exciting, guys.
It is. It's really cool. I mean, you know, this is a big project that we were excited about at the start of the year, and it's really nice to see it start to grow and gain momentum, though I admit it's a little bit scary to hear that there are wealth management CEOs that hear me talk about baseball cards and whatever other stupid stuff I include as interludes in my Hank Hill impression.
Yeah, well, we can do all of those at the end of the episode to kind of, you know, play a bit of bingo. Very quickly, here's some questions for you about things that are 50. Do you want to know some things that are 50? It's not really a question, actually. It's just me reading a list. These are 50 years rather than the 50 episodes, but the Rubik's Cube. It's a fun one. Yep. Skittles. Like, the, you know, I was going to say the sweets, but the candy, as Americans would say. What else is 50? This is a weird one. By the way, obviously, this is just from sort of, you know, Google, ChatGPT. The Heimlich maneuver is 50 years old. What were people doing before? Like 1974, it's just no way of helping them. They have to choke. And then 1975, figured it out. Anyway, that's apparently 50. Do you want to know some things that are also reached 50 episodes or there and thereabouts?
Please.
Yep, good, good. This is good. This is good content. Well, the show Broad City, this, our readers, our listeners won't know that. Breaking Bad, 60 episodes. Good Girls, 50 episodes. The Wire, only 60 episodes. So look, we're 10 episodes away from basically being in the same bracket as The Wire and Breaking Bad, which I think we can all agree we very much are.
Oh yeah,
I do think there's we have to call out the different. I think we're more like a, obviously not in content, but in terms of how this is produced, a lot more like a South Park, where it all comes together fairly last minute within the confines of the news that has happened in the past week. South Park's been on what, I don't know how many episodes now, but something to aspire towards, perhaps.
Okay, yeah, that's our trajectory. Although I don't like you giving away the behind the curtain look at how this gets put together, because I'm sure the listener is thinking, wow, these guys are professional. Good. Well, look, I think we've done enough on that particular thing. We're going to round off this episode by sort of looking back at the year, looking back at some of the biggest stories. Got a fun quiz for you, which will be an actual quiz this time, not just me reading a list off the internet. But before we do have a bit of business to get to, because there's been one more big story, and we're going to use that to kind of round off the year. And it's a big deal, Ian, basically, which is very much up our street, very much a sort of core Wenick piece of content. So, yeah, what's the deal? And then we'll get into what it all means.
It's very funny because we discussed, thinking about the structure for this episode, that inevitably there'd be some sort of major story that we'd break, which would become emergency pod level. And we got that in the scoop that we got on December 9th. That Corient, one of the largest independent RAs in the country, in the world, for that matter. I'll debate whether an RA is in the global or not. We'll get into that a little bit later. Anyway, we heard that Corient, from several sources with knowledge of the situation, held talks to acquire Altie Global, which manages about $89 billion, is one of the few publicly traded independent wealth managers. And that deal would take Altie off the public markets.
Yeah, X is a massive story for lots of reasons, both sides of this potential deal. And we should emphasize that it is just that they've been in talks. I think it's fair to say there's no guarantees that leads to anything, not 100% clear where those talks are currently. So caveats added for measure and balance, etc. But yeah, massive for two reasons. Obviously, Coyent, really interesting firm. Ulti, a very interesting firm, probably less well known, I think, in some quarters, partly because it changed its name. Which one do you want to start with first, Ian?
Ooh, I mean, I feel like we haven't really gotten into the whole Ulti saga super closely. So let's start with that.
Yeah, maybe listeners won't be as familiar with that firm as well. So yeah, maybe walk everyone through sort of how Ulti became what it is now. And then we can go into Coriant, and then we can go into why there's a deal or maybe a deal going on.
Yes. So Ulti Global is the product of a SPAC merger. Remember SPACs? It is the product of a SPAC merger between a SPAC known as Cartesian Growth Corp, Tiedemann Advisors, a large ultra high net worth focus REA based in New York City, and Alvarium Investments, which is a British money manager that operates several different types of funds. We'll get into that. The deal to combine these companies was originally revealed in late 2021. It did not officially close and get the company publicly listed as a combined entity till January of 2023. That was due to a couple of factors, including the broader decline in the equity markets we saw in 2022 and just people moving on from SPACs.
Yeah.
And the shares have basically underperformed. They're down north of, before we broke the story, the shares are trading around like $4.60. They've jumped since. But that $4.62 mark as of the day we broke the story, that was about
just to be clear, sorry, the story of them being in talks.
Yes, of them being in talks. They're down 51% since inception. The shares have plunged.
Since it's IPO.
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, that's not gone well. And the delays around it, okay, you can't say necessarily were specific to those businesses, but it doesn't perhaps bode hugely well that it took so long to kind of get that over the line. It's public, but there are some big investors in it as well.
Yes, that's correct. So there are three big institutional sponsors. The first is Allianz, German insurer and asset management giant, and Constellation Wealth Capital, frequent friend of the show, major REA investor backed by Carl Heckenberg, formerly of Emgrid Partners.
Or run by him, I suppose, backed by his investors, right?
Yes, that's correct, including the Blue Owl co-founders. So Allianz and Constellation Wealth Capital invested a combined $400 million or so with warrants to purchase additional $50 million in shares in 2024. Allianz is the largest individual shareholder in Ulti. And then Ilwadi Holdings, which is an investment firm that's tied to Sheikh Jassim Abdulaziz Al Thani, who is a member of the Qatari royal family, the former crown prince, he also has a stake. So Ilwadi has a seat on the board. Carl is a board observer. And Allianz has board representation as well. And it's worth noting that the majority of the company's shares are not publicly floated. And a lot of those are backed by management and the advisors at Ulti.
Okay. But it is effectively public, is it? Because enough of it is listed. And that is a rare thing, as we've discussed before in this podcast, to sort of see a wealth management firm on the public markets. And maybe there's a reason why there aren't very many on there, because as discussed, the share price hasn't done very much positive since being publicly traded. And obviously it means that, you know, everything has to be reported publicly. And there's been some things that probably haven't been great for it to report about since the SPAC and the IPO.
Yes, and you can expand on this a little bit too. There have been some operational issues tied to some of the entities originally associated with Alvarium. A good example was their international real estate business, which they've chosen to wind down. And they've also taken some impairment charges recently on their arbitrage fund. And so those two factors combined. So when Ulti reported its earnings for the third quarter after a delay, they reported a GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, net loss of $107 million based on the impairment charge and the real estate business. Now, they did some adjustments. They did show, I believe, a net profit for the quarter based on those adjustments. But still, Also worth noting that they reported adjusted EBITDA of $6 million on $57 million in revenue for the third quarter 2025. And you know, you can put that kind of in context of some of the EBITDA figures we've reported on for some of these big REs in the past. It's not the same.
Yeah, I can't speak to it hugely well. I guess we as a collective, we're obviously more focused on the US clearly and the US wealth industry. So that the Tiedemann part of the deal is maybe where we have a bit more expertise. But yeah, Alvarion wound down this property business, I think around the same time that came out. Yeah, so the main thing that I know about this is that it was the manager of a closed-end fund in the UK called Home REIT. And things went, you know, not very well at all, basically. And per our colleagues in the UK reporting on this, Alvarium and some, I suppose, affiliated companies with it, entered into liquidation. That was, I think, reported in July of this year. They'd previously run this, they'd gone into administration, basically. I think that obviously speaks to the write down then that the wider company made. But yeah, that obviously hasn't gone well. You spoke to some other things that are in those accounts which don't look brilliant. Does seem to be more that side of the fence than anything that sort of has gone on with Tiedemann, which you would otherwise think is a very solid, you know, lucrative business, right? Managing really super high net worth wealth in the US tends to be a good thing to be doing.
Yeah, they've made some acquisitions too. They bought a big RA, East End Advisor, so they've been active.
Yeah, but then why? But they're up for sale, I guess, in part because of that share price being down, so they look attractive. They're obviously, you know, a potential buyer sees things in there beyond some of those headlines, which still look really good and would be worth buying. And our reporting this week, your reporting specifically, is that Corient is one of the firms looking at it.
Yes, that's correct. We've reported that Corient has held talks with them to acquire them. Talks have intensified between the two sides over the last couple of weeks. It does not appear like a deal has been finalized, and you know, a deal between these two sides might not happen. There's definitely other prospective suitors interested in acquiring Alti.
But Alti has, so again, I'm just cribbing your reporting here now. Alti appointed JPM to be its advisor for this process, and can I break a little story on the pod, or do you want to save this nugget for afterwards as to who's representing Corient?
We'll save it, but they do have financial. Right. They do have an advisor.
I'm sorry, listener. We know stuff. We can't always share it. Okay. All right. They have an advisor. So can we talk about Corient for a minute then? Because
please.
Corient used to be CI Financial, and for a while, they pretty much did a deal every week. There was a period when they were going nuts, bananas, choose your healthy snack. But they've been much quieter. They've changed their name. They've gone through some sort of structural, organizational backing changes. And the deals that they're either doing or potentially pursuing are very different. So could you walk us through that a little?
Yes. So I'm going to leave some of this for Andrew because he did some great reporting around the time of 2023 on this. But for context, so the current state of Corient is that it is a $218 billion wealth manager based out of Miami, but it is controlled by CI Financial, which is a Toronto-based asset manager. CI, Corient, they went on a very aggressive RIA acquisition spree around 2020, 2021, 2022. It drew some criticism from other industry figures. The company grew very fast, very quickly. They moved to consolidate its network of RA holdings onto a single form ADV, tried to find some integrations. CI sought unsuccessfully to spin out a portion of the wealth unit, back then CI Private Wealth, now Corient, through an IPO. The IPO did not materialize. They did a private investment deal, sold about 20% stake in the unit. And then very recently, this transaction literally closed in the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. Mubadala Capital, which is an affiliate of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Investing Business, I believe it's Mubadala Investment Company. So Mubadala bought all of CI, which includes now a controlling stake in Corient. And Corient has become acquisitive again. They are going to pass $430 billion in client assets after it closes deals to buy Stonehage Fleming, which is a global multifamily office, and Stanhope Capital, a European wealth manager. And those deals will close in early 2026.
Okay, excellent. So just to recap a little bit, because an awful lot in there, and again, just phenomenal work there, Ian. No notes from me, but also crucially, no notes from you in reciting all that, listener. You know, it's a thing of wonder, really. Has to be seen to be believed. But okay, so there was a sort of world in which, you know, CI might have, or what's now Corient, the CI's wealth business might have IPO'd and been in this slightly sort of tricky public place, but instead it's probably in the exact place that you want to be, which is sort of semi-permanent capital at this point.
Yes, semi-permanent capital that has a bottomless well of money that it can throw behind you.
And that's changed the profile then clearly of the types of firms it's acquiring. So you refer to this period when what was then called CI, but now Corient, was doing an awful lot of acquisitions, but those tended to be sort of US RIAs, sort of mid-sized US RIAs, regional wealth businesses. And now it's sort of going after, or I mean, has indeed just made two sort of international high-end wealth acquisitions. So a different vibe to that 21-22 period.
Well, they made some big deals back then too. They bought Siegel, Bryant & Hamill, which was a massive both RIA and investment outsourcing business as well.
Okay, fair. Andrew, do you have any anything?
Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's, you're right that sort of their profile as a buyer has changed a bit. I think they came in, I mean, as we've said, they were, you know, really running an aggressive kind of capital deployment campaign. They were outbidding everybody else on the market. And really just consolidating. I think lately they have been, this is sort of anecdotal. I'm not sure I've talked to anybody there, whether or not this is sort of a specific strategy, but they've been acquiring a lot of multifamily offices. I think that might just be a consequence of that market heating up within the wealth space here in the US. I mean, multifamily offices are hot properties right now. And obviously Corient is well capitalized. So they've been going after a lot of kind of regional multifamily offices. That I think is interesting. And then if we've mentioned the Stonehage Fleming deal, you know, those were obviously huge. And if they're talking to Alti, I mean, that indicates something about, how much money they're willing to kind of throw around on single deals. I mean, obviously they see something that might be accretive for them there. So bit of a signal on sort of what they're looking for and what their appetite is.
Absolutely. And I suppose, again, if we're sort of, speculating, which basically we are, those previous deals mentioned, Stonehage, Fleming, and sorry, Ian, Stanhope, am I saying that right? Have I got it wrong?
Stanhope Capital, yes.
Stanhope Capital, okay, yeah. It would fit, wouldn't it? You know, the Tiedemann's profile, both sort of high net worth, sort of Tiedemann part of it, sorry, Alti rather than Tiedemann, and obviously having some sort of European exposure as well, sort of being not just a US-based thing. Okay, so what next? Just to sort of wait and see, Ian? I don't know. I know you don't like me trying to tease you into delivering stories on the podcast because you want to write them as stories, which is fair enough. But are there any other bidders? Do we think that we're going to see other people emerge? Or is it just this?
I think we'll see. I think that we'll see some other, at least private equity sponsors, emerge. I think that Corient probably makes the most sense as a suitor from a strategic perspective, because Corient obviously has these global aspirations. It would kind of track buying a firm like Alti that also, they have a Swiss office, they have this major European presence through Alvarium. It would make sense for those two to kind of come together. Now, there are other RIAs that have global ambitions. Maybe one of them could emerge or could view Alti as a way to kind of accelerate that. But I would say that, especially considering how well capitalized Corient is right now, they make the most sense as a strategic.
Okay. And very quickly then, do we think, you touched on it, I suppose, for a moment there, do we think this is something that we're going to see from more sort of predominantly US-based RIAs, that another leg to the acquisition strategy is going to be going global? I feel like it's been kicked around before, but I suppose there was enough good assets to buy in the US. Maybe that's getting tighter, hotter, harder. I'm not sure.
Well, you saw Focus went for Canada for a while, but I think they trimmed that.
They did.
A little bit, and they've sold some of those properties off. So I don't know if you can really lump that in as a indicator one way or another.
Yeah, well, I think that's my kind of question, which is I think people do this from time to time, and Canada, then I suppose UK, Switzerland, Australia, those tend to be the markets people go for, mature wealth markets, et cetera, obviously, decent demographics. But I don't know how much it sort of sticks. Are there really true global independent wealth management firms, and I'm not talking about your UBSs and things like that. Is it a model that's worked? I mean, someone's going to write in and go, yes, you idiot, and name like three really obvious firms. But you get the point I'm trying to make.
I mean, look, Focus is trying to kind of shrink down and get out of that, a lot of those foreign businesses. So who knows? I mean, I can see arguments both ways, basically.
Excellent. Well, look, let's move on from that. Thank you both very much indeed. Fantastic recap of that. And look, we'll, basically watch this space and specifically watch www.citywire.com/RIA for more news. Now let's pivot. Let's pivot to some fun. It's the end of the year, as we've established, and we're in our 50th episode. So I want to use this to do a little recap of the biggest stories of the year. Regular listeners, you can play along too, but I've got a little quiz for Ian and Andrew. It's going to be looking at... Now, we did a sort of half year, which was a bit similar, Ian, where we looked at our best read stories. And so I thought you might have a bit of a head start. So I've changed the parameters of the quiz. All right. I saw this coming. And I've moved my chess pieces accordingly. So instead of looking at our most read stories, I'm going to look at a slightly different metric that we track. So I'm going to look at, no cheating, Ian, I'm not in the studio with you, but you have to promise me that you're not going to be using your laptop for nefarious means now. I'm going to look instead at the stories, most registrations. A little bit different.
All right.
This is
all right.
New people deciding to sign up for the wonderful CityWire RIA news service and our newsletter. So which stories made people do that? I mean, look, it's broadly pretty much correlated. So I have got in front of me, I've got the top 20 from January 1st through to December 11th. I couldn't get the data for today. I don't think it makes a difference. So would you like to guess, either one of you, fingers on figurative buzzers, what the piece, what do you want to call it, story, article that we published that got the most people to sign up was this year?
I feel pretty confident that the LPL Commonwealth acquisition has to be top three.
Okay, Andrew, do you want to put a guess in? Do you want to put a bit in?
I would say pay report has got to be up there, and I would also say anything to do with the custodial referrals programs probably is going to be pretty high on those lists.
Okay, so pay report is in at number two. So I think 1 point to Andrew for that. And then I have to take out some numbers here for a second. One, two. Okay. LPL Commonwealth is number five, Ian. So, I think you both get a point. Maybe Andrew gets two because he was closer to it. So good stuff. And we're going to come on and talk about, I think, some of these stories in a moment. But let's finish the game first, because I imagine everyone is, waiting with bated breath. Anyone want to have another stab at the number one?
I'll take it's definitely going to be one of the Schwab stories. I'm going to guess it's going to be Schwab quadrupling the minimum threshold for a referral.
So raising the fees on advisor referrals, as opposed to raising the threshold.
No, I'm going with raising the threshold as opposed to the fee raise. I'm going to go raising the threshold.
Okay, so you're saying when Schwab said actually clients need to have 2 million for us to refer you to the network. Okay, rather than 500,000. So no, not even, it's high. It's in the top 20. And these are all big numbers. None of these stories are done badly. But that story is towards the, where is it now? Anyway, it's not. It's about number 14, I would say. So,
did we have anything this year on cash management products? I would guess that those stories all did pretty well. Although I think a lot of that was mainly 2024. I would have guessed fees on the referral platform probably would have been above the story Ian just mentioned, if for no other reason than it was sitting out there for another, extra couple of months, maybe have just benefited from more time.
Yeah, no, you are right about that.
Sat on the
it
shelf.
It comes in four places higher, the fees on the referral business, so actually raising the fees.
It wouldn't have been a Fidelity held away asset story. I know that did quite well.
That did do very well. That's top five. It's top five. It's one, two, three. It's number four. Oh. So weirdly, I mean, it comes in just above the LPL.
She's guessed everything except number one.
I have a
really
guess.
Yeah.
Is it the Cathra Capital Management CEO who competed in the Masters?
No, it's not, but that was a smash. We should come on to that, our minor line in sort of celebrity and TV news reporting. We had the
Bachelor.
The Bachelor contestant. She won, right? She actually won.
She did win, yes. They didn't
we
make
should
it,
do a
but she won.
Up. Where is she now? You know, that's the story people are crying out for just before Christmas, I think. I'm not even really joking about that, to be honest. But look, I'll give you a clue, guys. We all worked on it. It's massively stressful, and it's not actually a new story.
Oh, 50 Growers.
Oh, 50 Growers, man.
Yeah.
I was right there.
But this is good. This added tension. If you'd have got it straight away, where would the fun have been? So yeah, 50 Growers report on the fastest 50 Growers. The fastest. Well, hang on. Technically, it's the fastest growing RIA in every state. In some cases, we name two or three. So there are, in fact, I think it was 143 firms named in that report. But yeah, the headline being the fastest in every state. Fantastic piece of work. I think we talked about it a lot. I hope that anyone listening to the podcast is probably already aware of it. But if you're not, we'll put a link in the description. It's a wonderful piece of work. Okay. So yeah, I think there is still one big story that you haven't got, which surprised me, actually. And Ian, I think you would be surprised too. It's a story that you broke. It's a deal that ultimately didn't happen.
Oh, is it the Edelman failed sale?
It is. Well, the story that actually got the most registration was that it was looking for a deal.
Yes.
But yeah, that was the. So here's the order: 50 Growers most registrations, followed by the pay report. Followed by Financial Engines, Edelman, mulling a sale to a strategic acquirer. Then Fidelity's, sort of Sam's Fidelity, Pontera, crackdown on sort of credential sharing. Then, one, two, three, four stories in a row, all about LPL and somehow related to the Commonwealth deal. The most registered of those, I suppose, being the initial story that we broke, that LPL, you know, was in talks to buy Commonwealth. And there's a few other odd ones in here. Nothing crazy. But yeah, then you get down to Schwab raising the fees, Pershing charging asset-based fees for some RIAs.
That was a fun one.
Schwab again with the raising the threshold. And then actually this is a late little entrant as well, which I think is one of the biggest stories of the year too, was the Open Arc's departure from Merrill Lynch. So the sort of $129 billion odd team that left Merrill to go independent. So perhaps we could just use this very quickly to reflect on some of those. So Schwab, it tells you the stories of the year, doesn't it? LPL Commonwealth, you know, transformational deal. Schwab and the various changes that it's been making to its sort of custodial business, and specifically its RIA referral program, obviously a massive deal. Edelman, I think it's kind of fitting that it's in there because that also speaks to a massive trend this year. And then perhaps that Open Arc story at the end. I think those do sort of all four speak to some of the biggest things. So let's recap some of those. Well, not recap, maybe just add a little bit if we can to either of those. So LPL Commonwealth, end of year update, Ian. Where's things at, basically?
Yeah, I mean, LPL has said broadly that they're tracking to hit their retention targets. At the same time, we've been reporting on a steady drip of advisors who have left to go to various
left
channels.
Commonwealth, we should
yes,
say.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that have left Commonwealth. We've written about advisors going to independent financial partners, Osaic, all over the place. So there's been a steady drip. Again, I would say that the...
We even had Mike Durbin on last week's pod telling us, you know, they've been pretty successful. Okay, obviously he's going to talk his book, but it does suggest that it's, you know, it's not all gone LPL's way.
the proof will be in the pudding when we get to the conversion date. Who's going to actually stay or go when LPL, when the Commonwealth systems all transfer over to LPL and we have clients actually moving over? That's going to be the main question.
And that D-Day is when, to unfairly put you on the spot?
Sometime in 2026.
Okay, brilliant. And then I think Rich Steinmeier was reported this week. I think he was speaking at the Goldman Sachs conference. He did sort of say some of the conversations have been
slower
than he thought. I don't know if we want to read too much into that, but you know, it's hard yards basically, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, brilliant. But yeah, transformative deal, obviously took one of the top five biggest broker dealers off the market, obviously makes LPL meaningfully larger, and we know that, you know, Commonwealth was a hot property that a lot of other people would have been interested in. Okay, so let's talk Schwab very quickly then. I feel like we've discussed it mostly on the pod. We don't need to add tons to it, but effectively, you know, the fee hike had been a long time in the coming. It isn't huge, but it's notable. And then obviously the threshold hike, also notable. Basically, you know, what would you say? Not quite pulling up the ladder on the referral program, but certainly sort of tightening things up a little.
Yeah, that is a good way. That is a good way to put it. I mean, I think, you know, there's nothing out there that is incentivizing Schwab to stop doing this. The bottom line is that they have, you know, a tremendous amount of power in this industry. A lot of firms are dependent on this. They can do whatever they see fit with it. And it's worth noting that, oh, there is competition potentially coming. We've written about Pershing and Goldman and Robinhood potentially preparing referral programs of their own, but
Betterment as well.
Yes, and Betterment. But it'll take time for those to get off the ground.
Yeah, and they won't be as lucrative just because they don't
have the
branch network that Schwab has, right? They won't have as many clients or probably as big a clients to refer. So it's not as if you're swapping one for one, we should say. Basically, Schwab can do this because it's sort of the biggest and the best.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I feel like we definitely discussed that enough. Let's talk about two more stories then quickly. Let's talk about Edelman. We discussed in the pod relatively recently after that sale didn't happen, basically, and they sort of switched up the CEO since. But yeah, just how meaningful is that as a kind of a marker for the year, sort of 2025, the first time we saw a big strategic deal not take place, and what that might say about the whole sort of PE-fueled acquisition merry-go-round.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like we talked about. I'll let Andrew hop in on this too. I mean, I think it just shows that, you know, it's tough to grow. It's a law of large numbers thing a little bit, is that as you get bigger, the ability to drive or record meaningful organic growth is a little bit tougher. It's worth noting that obviously Edelman had a massive base of retirement plan assets, which are just inherently lower margin. But seeing that not get done, I think, should give people pause about what the end game is like for these firms, especially if they're not growing at the rate that the PE investors demand.
Andrew.
Yeah, I think it also maybe just says something about if you, and we've seen this kind of sparingly with big processes, it's tough when you go out to market looking for a certain number. And if you don't get it, you're just not going to transact, you know? I don't know. It can be difficult if there's a misalignment between what you're looking for, and then obviously private equity's got its own view of, you know, the potential for what it can do with your business. So I think that's just an example of what we've seen with Edelman.
Excellent. And then the last story I think we can touch on as being a sort of, you know, a real marker for 2025 was OpenArc's departure, that massive team from Merrill. Again, we talked about it relatively recently on the pod, so we don't perhaps need to go chapter and verse on this. But yeah, massive team leaving, went to Dynasty. Andrew, you reported quite a lot on this. There were sort of lawsuits and things. But in terms of what it says, you know, I guess that no team is too big to leave. That does that sort of set a marker down to the wires that really anyone can go, and that the independent wealth space is capable of doing that sort of lift out.
Yeah, absolutely that. And I think as well, Alex's story on the court denying Merrill's request for a TRO was just as big and just as big a signal. You know, I mean, every break is going to be different. There's going to be different kind of details and legal minutiae to kind of tease out of all that. But it's it's meaningful that these guys were able to break away with the process that they did, and, you know, avoid a TRO, and they've set up shop. I mean, yeah, the breakaway movement is. This is another thing. I mean, we write all the time about breakaways, but I think like the largest population of advisors in the country are still at wirehouses and in captive models. And so I think, yeah, anybody saying, you know, breakaway movement is slowing down, that's just, I just don't see it.
Yeah, and the pipeline's still huge because those firms are still
exactly.
Huge. Okay, this is fascinating. I think those stories actually do very neatly kind of capture the most noteworthy kind of items of 2025. Before we go then, prediction time. This is unfair, but I suppose anything that you can see coming next year that perhaps hasn't happened. So that's a stupid way of asking that question, isn't it? Big predictions for next year in the RIA and wealth space. Anyone want to hazard a guess about something, you know, that you think we might be reporting on and discussing on this podcast over the next 12 months?
Well, we're going to see a massive amount of sponsor-backed firms enter the market next year. This is right coming up on 5 years out from the 2021 just insane surge of deal-making. So, I mean, if you told me that next year we'll see Allworth come to market and Carson Group come to market and Wealth Enhancement come to market, I would not be shocked whatsoever. And I wonder what's going to happen when we have this crush of all these mega institutional class firms competing for investors at the same time.
Yeah, and I suppose in light of the Edelman story this year, do all of them achieve the valuation they want to or that their sponsors would want them to? That'll be a really interesting thing to watch.
Exactly.
Okay. Andrew, Ian's taken maybe the sort of, I'm not saying the easiest prediction, he's taken a gem of a prediction there. Can you match?
Yeah, I maybe not for 2026, but as long as I've been covering the space, there's been talk of a merger of equals, a mega merger among leading U.S. wealth managers. Hasn't happened. We occasionally hear rumblings that maybe talks are happening, but nothing meaningful. I don't know if 2026 is going to be the year, but with all of these properties, potentially on the market, maybe something can get found there and maybe something more material does start to happen there. So I don't know, maybe it's not 2026, but the mega merger is coming, I think.
Yeah, but I think those two predictions, yeah, there definitely is overlap, isn't there? One could lead to the other very, very well. Brilliant. Yeah, do we think we're going to see anything more in that sort of custodian place? Do we see maybe Fidelity kind of moving to match Schwab or other people trying to sort of,
I think they'll just, I want to hear Ian's take on this as well, but I don't know, it just to read the signs, like I think they'll just continue to grow their own in-house wealth management practices, right? I mean, I think they will, their profile as competitors to wirehouses, you know, big national RIAs, I think that will continue.
Yeah, I agree.
Brilliant. Well, look, I think on that note, we've covered it. Unless there was anything else, Ian, baseball, basketball, trading cards, TV watching. Was there anything you wanted to end the year on? A message to the readers, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good chance that it'll all be outdated by then. So I'm going to hold off, but I will thank every single person who's listened to an episode for giving us a chance to be in your podcast newsfeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's worth seconding, isn't it? We don't take that lightly. We know there's a lot of no shortage of people chatting away on podcasts out there. So thanks everyone for listening. Thanks everyone for reading as well. We're really appreciative of all our readers. We're growing every day, which is great. And if you have feedback, do let us know. You can email us news@citywireusa.com, whether it's about the podcast, whether it's about the website, or whether it's about college basketball, although you will have to put, you know, for Ian's attention, because I will be able to add nothing to that. But yeah, thank you, everyone. Andrew, before we go, anything he wants to add?
No, just thanks. It's been a great year. Yeah, a lot of fun covering the space, and thank you all for listening and reading.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, look, on that note, thank you, Ian and Andrew, and we'll be back again next year for another episode of This Week in Wealth.